The great Dr. Johnson was once asked what he thought about women speaking in public. And he replied that a woman speaking in public was like a dog standing on its hind legs. People admired her not for doing it well, but for doing it at all. And if I'd been asked to talk this morning about translating the Bible, that's no proof, I'm afraid, that I'm supposed to have translated it better than other people. But I have translated it, and I imagine I am the only person alive who has translated the Bible into English all through. When I say the Bible, I don't mean just the Bible as it is ordinarily printed. I include the part which you probably call the Apocrypha, the Book of Wisdom, and the two books of Maccabees, and so on, which makes it much longer, about 1/7 as long again. It took me 9 years to do it, and whether I did it well or badly, it's not for me to say, but in the course of those 9 years, I did form some fairly distinct notions about how the thing ought to be done, if it's going to be done well. And those notions I'm passing on to you this morning, in case any of you should be trying your hand at it later on. Two hints I'd like to give you from the start. The first is this. If you're setting out to translate the Bible, do it all yourself. Or, at any rate, if you're pressed for time, do the New Testament yourself and get a friend, one friend, not more, to do the Old Testament for you. You see, a good translation has style. The translator puts something of himself into his work. He doesn't regard words as mere symbols, each word in every language having an exact and invariable equivalent in every other language. Of course, if you're acting as an interpreter for the United Nations, or some other international body, no difficulty of the kind arises. Every word has its exact equivalent then. An Englishman gets up and says, Her Majesty's government have studied the note communicated by the representatives of the Patagonian Republic and regret that they feel compelled to reject it as unacceptable. They are, however, exploring avenues along the lines indicated by the note and are not without hopes of discovering a formula by which an approximation between the two viewpoints could be achieved while safeguarding the interests of both parties. All that you'll be able to translate into Spanish or any other language under the sun, because it is all journalistic claptrap, and all the words in it are mere symbols, mere counters. Translation in that sense is as easy as falling off a log. But it's different when you're translating literature and when you're translating it into literature. Then you've got to take hold of the meaning of your original and decide what is the perfect way of expressing the same idea in English. Translation in that sense is creative. Translation, as you see it in Urquhart's Rabelais, or Jowett's Plato, or Charles Scott Moncrief's Proust. Now, if you sign on as one of a team for translating the New Testament, and agree to do, say, the Acts of the Apostles, the first thing which happens is that the general editor sends you round an enormous list of words that have got to be translated each in a certain way, each by a fixed equivalent, so as to make the whole thing uniform throughout. That means that you're not a free agent. You're working to a formula. And when you've finished your stuff and shown it up, the general editor goes through it with a blue pencil, for all the world like a schoolmaster, and cuts things out and puts things in and alters the order of words in the sentence, until it isn't your translation any longer. No, don't let somebody else call the tune. Do the whole thing yourself. And the second hint I want to give you is this. Try to forget that anybody has translated the Bible before. That is uncommonly difficult, because we all know the Bible so well in some existing translation. Many of us have heard it read aloud ever since we were small, and can repeat whole passages by heart. All of us are familiar with a lot of phrases in it, because they've become part of the language. Did you know that the words, "I have escaped by the skin of my teeth," are a quotation from the book of Job? They are. Unto the third and fourth generation, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. A soft answer, turneth away wrath. Charity covers a multitude of sins. If you get into the rut of remembered phrases like that, you will find that you're not translating the Bible at all. You're simply producing a slightly revised edition of the Bible with which we're all familiar. These revised editions are always coming out, especially in the United States. But what does it really amount to? You think the word abide is a rather old-fashioned sort of word, and so you change it to stay. You think the word stink is a rather vulgar sort of word, so you change it to smell. You think the word similitude is rather obscure, so you change it into likeness. But when you've done all that, you've not produced a new translation of the Bible. You've only produced a hodgepodge. You've changed it just enough to annoy the people who like to have everything left as it is. You haven't changed it enough to make it, in any considerable degree, easier to understand. You see, it is a complete mistake to suppose that the Bible is written in old-fashioned English, and that's why we find it difficult to understand. The point isn't that the Bible, as most of us know it, is written in old-fashioned English. The point is that it isn't written in English at all. Our standard translations were made in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, at a period of acute controversy, when Christians of every denomination were wrangling furiously with one another and trying to prove one another in the wrong by producing quotations from the Bible. Consequently, if you were translating the Bible, you wanted to make a literal word-for-word rendering. Otherwise, people would say you'd cooked your quotations. That's what our English Bibles are in the main, a literal word-for-word translation from Hebrew in the Old Testament, from Greek in the New. I'm not saying that such a translation may not be Greek literature. I'm only saying that it isn't English literature. Take a sentence like this. The Lord do so to me and more also, if I suffer this son of Belial to come in and go out as yesterday and the day before. Yea, if I do not smite him with the edge of the sword and cut him off from his people and make his dwelling place an abomination and a hissing to all them that pass by. That's not a sentence taken from the Bible. It's one which I've made up by way of an example. I think a quite fair example. Now, it's no good trying to make out that a sentence like that is written in old-fashioned English. Shakespeare didn't talk like that any more than you and I do. The point is that it is not English at all, because although you've translated the words into English, you've not translated the ideas into English. You've not carried them across from the idiom of one language into the idiom of another. We don't, and we never did, talk about the edge of the sword, or describe a house as a hissing to all them that pass by. It's Hebrew, dressed up as English. So that's one uncomfortable thought I want to leave with you about your translation of the Bible when you do it. It's got to be a translation of ideas, not merely of words. That makes the translator's job difficult enough, even when he's concerned with a comparatively modern original. For instance, if you sit down to translate the French national anthem, the Marseillaise, your first literal effort will be this. Let us go, children of the fatherland. The day of glory has arrived. Against us, the bloody standard of tyranny is uplifted. Well, there's a string of English words, and they represent the French words accurately enough. But your rendering isn't really English. No Englishman sitting down to write a patriotic song would have written like that. Even the first word, allons, which is translated in your French grammar, let us go, will have to be altered somehow into the kind of English an Englishman would have written. If he'd wanted to be poetic, he might have said forward. If he wanted to be prosaic, he might have said, come on. But he certainly wouldn't have said, let us go. And when you're dealing with an ancient language that comes down to us from an ancient civilization, your difficulties are increased. What are you to do, for example, about that splendid phrase which is so common in the Old Testament, so-and-so slept with his fathers? You see the grandeur of the idea, the living king joining the ranks of the dead kings. But what way is there of expressing that in English, or in the New Testament, he that hath ears to hear, let him hear? What formula will give the exact effect of that? And there's a fresh difficulty arising out of this. If you're not going to render the original literally, word by word, as the older translators did, how can you be certain that you're not interpreting your original, that you're not fastening a special meaning onto it, which may, after all, be the wrong meaning? To give you a single instance of that, St. John in the Apocalypse, or the Revelations, as it's sometimes called, describes the vision he had of God's throne in heaven, in front of which, he tells us, there was a sea of glass. It always used to puzzle me when I was small. Was it just a very calm sea? Or ought one to think of it as an actual expanse of glass, like an enormous mirror? It was only when I was translating the Bible that I noticed a curious sidelight you get on it in the Old Testament. When Solomon was building his temple, he set up in front of the porch what is called a sea of brass. Apparently a huge basin or tank, more than a man's height and 15 feet in circumference. And I have very little doubt, personally, that this was the image in St. John's mind when he was describing God's throne in the Apocalypse. The sea in front of the throne wouldn't be a large expanse of water, but a huge basin, like the basin in front of Solomon's temple. Only this one was not made of brass, but of glass, which in his day was a very rare and precious substance. What fun to bring that out in the translation? I hadn't the courage to. I called it a sea of glass, like everybody else. I've said that if you are translating the Bible, you ought to translate it into English. But English, what period? The English of Shakespeare? Or the English of Dr. Johnson? Or the literary English of today, or the colloquial English of today? You suggest, perhaps, that colloquial English would be best, or at all events it would be easiest. Well, it isn't as easy as you think. The most courageous attempt made in recent years to do something of the kind is, I suppose, Mr. Phillips's translation of the Epistles, which he calls Letters to Young Churches. I notice that Mr. Phillips, when he comes across a sentence which gives the reason for what has been said in the foregoing sentence, begins it with the word for. And when he does that, he's forgotten that he's trying to write colloquial English. In colloquial English, we never do anything of the kind. In refusing an invitation, you don't say, I'm afraid I can't, for I've got a man coming to see me. You say, I'm afraid I can't, I've got a man coming to see me. The word for, in that sense, is obsolete English, as dead as mutton. The difficulty of translating a thing into modern English isn't nearly so much a question of words as a question of how you arrange your sentences. For example, the first 7 verses of St. Paul's epistle to the Romans are all one long sentence. They are all one long sentence, both in Moffat's modern translation and in Goodspeed's modern translation. But which of you ever started a letter with a sentence 128 words long? If you take my advice, and it's the last piece of advice you're going to get, you will aim at translating the New Testament into a kind of timeless English. The sort of English which Shakespeare might have read without finding it odd, and the sort of English which you might come across in a modern newspaper without finding it odd. I don't say that's an easy thing to do, but the nearer you approach that standard, the better chance you have of making the reader feel that he's reading something rather important and rather solemn, and at the same time that it's meant not for people who lived nearly 2,000 years ago, but for him. When you get on, if you do get on, to the Old Testament, I think you'd be well advised to give it something of an old-fashioned flavour, simply because the kind of civilization it describes and the whole world of thought in which it moves are so very remote from us. To rewrite the history of the patriarchs in such a way as to make it sound as if it happened yesterday is to make it sound unreal and perhaps sometimes a tiny bit comic. I have before me an American translation of the book of Genesis, which describes how Abraham sent out his steward, Eliezer, to find a wife for his son Isaac. Eliezer sets out with 10 camels on a journey of 500 or 600 miles, and as he goes off, Abraham says, "The Lord in whose sight I have lived will send his angel with you and make your trip a successful." The word trip is all right if you are going by aeroplane, but somehow it doesn't quite convey the idea of 500 miles on camelback. There, that's the best advice I can give you. I hope you will do it to your own satisfaction. I warn you, it's almost too much to hope that you will do it to anybody else.